Conference record has joined the conference.
William, if you're shuffling papers, you should know it's coming through over the telephone.
I am in a shuffle-free zone.
Okay. Your picture just froze.
Ah.
There it is.
Well, I'll gesticulate. But we're going to start in about 2 minutes for everybody who is on. Thank you for standing by while we get ourselves situated.
Okay.
Dozens of our Jewish communal colleagues, and we're also being recorded, so be careful what you say.
Thank you for letting me know.
But you can say something like, go Buckeyes, with the whole world knowing that you are at
can
heart.
Can you see me? Can I do the Buckeye symbol?
Oh, I'll do the O, you'll do the H?
That's a deal, my man. I'll do the I, you can do the O, but I want to dot the I.
Absolutely.
Big thing, those of you know, with the marching band, whenever they play a home game, they give the honor of running out to dot the I after they spell Script Ohio to somebody of note. That's my life dream.
I could
dot the I at Ohio State Buckeyes.
Well, we have a very, as you know, very strong Jewish community in Ohio. I'm sure we could try to make that happen.
I think you should use your contacts for something that will benefit the Jewish people more than that.
Excellent. Well, we'll see if anybody tweets this, and maybe Ohio State will pick it up, and we'll give you a call, Alan.
Okay.
Perhaps
we're having a little bit of technical issues on in getting hooked up. Should we have a backup plan if we can't have any scenes?
Yeah, why don't we, I presume, and Hannah can, I don't see you, Hannah. Can you turn?
Oh, I see you.
Well, thank you very much.
Hi, Hannah.
Can you turn on
Hi
your...
Hi there. I see both of you.
You,
oh, you
see
can
yourself.
See me, Hannah?
Oh, wait a minute. Who am I seeing?
I don't think so.
I see Michael.
So the webinar is going to start soon, and it's 2:30, so it's going to start in the next couple minutes. Alan Gill, I think you got disconnected from the webinar. So if you can
I can hear you now. Can you hear me?
We can hear you, but we don't see you on the webinar.
So Alan Gill, if you can technologically sign yourself off and then on again, because it looks like you got disconnected, and we're going to start at 2:30.
And Hannah, can you turn on your camera?
It's on.
It is on, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, there I am.
Okay, I can't see you for some reason, but so let me just start.
I see
you. And should I turn it over to Alan? Right? Are you technologically prepared?
Well, William, you're gonna turn us off, so.
Okay. So let me start, and then we'll figure out the technological part. Maybe, Emily, you can text me what I need to do. So greetings, everyone. We are starting. We are live. It is 2:33 Eastern Time. I am William Daroff, the Senior Vice President for Public Policy and Director of the Washington Office of the Jewish Federations of North America. I am a Vice President of the JPRO Network, formerly known as the Jewish Communal Service Association. And it is my great pleasure to welcome everyone to this webinar on pursuing justice, working toward economic security, and helping those in need. As we transition from JCSA to the JPRO network, we will be pleased to continue our tradition of conference calls and webinars that bring knowledge and valuable skills to Jewish communal professionals. March is Professional Development Month, and we are pleased to kick off with recognition of this valued resource within this program. We'll close out the month with a conference call with the great Dr. Erica Brown, my neighbor here in Washington, D.C., which will be on March 26th. So take note of that, March 26th with Dr. Erica Brown. Please also place May 28th on your calendars for the JPRO Network Annual Program, which will be held at UJA Federation of New York in Manhattan. So again, May 28th will be our JPRO Network Annual Program at UJA Federation in New York. I'd also like to thank all of our affiliated agencies and supporters who bring this program to us and allow for this to happen, in particular, the Outran Foundation. And let me apologize for the sirens. One of the great benefits of being in Washington, D.C. is we have motorcades driving by all the time. In any event, thank you to the Outran Foundation for helping to make this program possible. We are going to, I'm going to introduce the three participants who will be addressing us, and then we'll have time for some Q&A. We'll give Q&A instructions down the road, but you will be able to type questions actually along the way, like you could type questions right now and as they come to you, and we will, as presenters might want to address them, they might, or when we get to the Q&A portion of this, we will take questions from that little box at the bottom of your screen. So let me start by introducing Alan Gill. Alan is the CEO of the American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee. He is one of the Jewish world's transformative professional leaders. His vision and career have exemplified and put into direct action the notion of global Jewish responsibility. Alan has been involved at JDC, has been a veteran there for over 20 years. He's played a key leadership role in many of the great programs that JDC does as a fellow Ohioan of sorts, as you heard during the previous parts of the pre-call. And as a friend, Alan is really one of the top leaders in the Jewish world today, and it's an honor to have him talk to us about pursuing justice, as well as an update on what's happening with the crisis in Ukraine. So with that, Alan, why don't you go first and speak for 7 to 10 minutes, and then I'll introduce Hannah, and we'll go from there. So, Alan, the podium is yours.
Thanks, William, and I want to thank everybody at JCSA, Brenda couldn't be with us today, for arranging today's webinar. I know it's a bit late, but because we had to postpone it due to events beyond our control, it's a special opportunity to speak with all of you today about the I Have a Dream speech, the call to action of the late, great Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. I was asked to say a few words about Ukraine. I could use all our time doing so, which is not what I believe you want, William, and what we want to accomplish today. What I will say is if you're not getting updates from us, we'll be happy to add you to our list. To all of my colleagues on the phone, please let us know. You can let William know, and he'll forward the request to JDC. I want to say that the situation in Ukraine took a lot of people, including experts, geopolitical scholars, by surprise. At the same time, from the onset of the crisis, the violence that ensued in Kiev, we've been on the ground. We are able to be there for the single most vulnerable Jews throughout Ukraine. Today, there are approximately 300 to 350,000 Jews, depending upon whose data one subscribes to. The Jews are pretty much split evenly east and west of the Dnieper River. The conflict, all of you read about its origins in the same journals, the same media that I do. Of course, we have some people whose opinions we rely a little bit more on, but nobody really knows where this is going. There are significant diplomatic efforts. Hopefully, we won't see an escalation. We'll see a de-escalation continue. At the same time, as I said, Kol Yisrael Arvim Zeh LaZeh, all Jews being responsible one for another, which is exactly what Williams kicked off the session with, is exactly what we're all about. We have our eyes on one ball, and that is the single most vulnerable Jews. About 20%, a little over 20% of the 300,000 to 350,000 elderly Jews, without question, the poorest Jews I've ever met in my life and could be the poorest Jews on earth. These are elderly people who survived both the double trauma of the Shoah and of communism. They are living on meager to worthless pensions, and we support them normally at a time of crisis. Who's most vulnerable? Those people are the most vulnerable. We were helping them in Kiev. We are now helping, of course, in Simferopol and Sevastopol, Theodosia in the Crimea. And we have our eye on the ball of the eastern cities, depending upon what might happen. That's Dnipropetrovsk and Lugansk, Donetsk, and, of course, Kharkov. Those are the major population centers, Jewishly. We are helping children as well, children and their families who are the most poor. Our other activities are continuing. They were shut down in Kiev during the heart of the crisis. We've now opened everything back up. What has happened to the most vulnerable is the economy has really spiraled downward. It was an economy that was already severely in trouble. In 2009, the Ukraine economy, only 4.5 years ago, contracted by 15%. It's very hard for us to imagine. We in the States shrank a halt over 2% growth, let alone a 15% economic contraction. Although it did come back to some extent, it never recovered. Prices are climbing. The Ukrainian hryvnia, their currency, has further weakened. Buying power has gone down. Excuse me. What we are doing is providing emergency assistance, stockpiling, helping people to stockpile food, medicine, hygienic supplies, cooking and heating fuel, and heaters, portable heaters, in the event of what we read about, possible gas and electricity shutoffs. So the crisis hasn't ended. It looks as if it's subsiding. We'll see what happens. But again, what I want to assure everybody, because I know I've gotten countless emails, my colleagues have, we are watching the most vulnerable Jews in the country, making sure that they're protected and that they're safeguarded from a standpoint of needing material aid during a time of crisis. Maybe there'll be questions after, and I can take them and happily respond. But I'd like to go back to Dr. King, Zichrono Livracha, and share with you something that he wrote, and I quote, "Philanthropy is commendable, but it must not cause the philanthropist to overlook the circumstances of economic injustice which make philanthropy necessary," unquote. Now at JDC, which works in Israel and more than 70 countries worldwide, we often see up close and personal the dire conditions that cause poverty. I mentioned Ukraine, we can go to Mumbai, we can look at Cordoba and Buenos Aires. This is what we do. We operationalize on a day-to-day basis global Jewish responsibility. And we address in different ways the heart, the core of these economic problems. I'd like to tell you one thing about what we do in Israel. And some of you may ask, why Israel? Why am I starting with Israel? Because a lot of folks don't know that in Israel today, we're looking at a poverty rate of children that's over one-third. Over one-third of the children in Israel today are living below the poverty line. Now, thank God, it's not the poverty line of Ethiopia and other developing countries. We're talking here, of course, about the startup nation. But a grave concern that many of us have is that there is increasingly becoming a left-behind nation. Not those who have, but those who don't have, the other Israel, so to speak. And it represents not only a Jewish humanitarian concern. One could argue, dear friend Rabbi Paley would probably say, if that were only it, dayenu, it's enough. However, we're talking about, in my opinion, and many people's opinions, who are far smarter than I, a strategic threat to the future of Israel. A 34% rate of poverty among children is simply not sustainable. So I want to tell you what a question that was recently asked to me as I was speaking about this in different fora. A gentleman asked me when I gave that number of over one-third. He said to me, what would it be? What would that statistic be if we took away the ultra-Orthodox Israelis and the Israeli Arabs? And I said, sir, I happen to know that answer because we sectoralize all the data because we have to know where to target our interventions. But I have a question to ask you. Where is a way? Where is it? And he looked at me and he was quiet, very pregnant pause, and he smiled and he said, I withdraw my question. The point is, poverty is disproportionately represented in those two sectors, and it is those two sectors the JDC, in partnership with the government of Israel and a host of other NGOs as well as private enterprise, has addressed and is stepping up its interventions to try to turn this around. So I want to tell you about one individual. His name is Akiva. He's a 33-year-old Haredi man who, like many of his community members, chose to study a life of study over work. He struggles to get by. This is not, poverty is really debilitating. He has four kids at home, and he realizes he needs to get work, and at the same time still maintain a lifestyle that highly values learning. So what's the solution? We have formed job training centers and job employment development centers to help ultra-Orthodox Israeli men find suitable employment, all being done under hashkacha, under rabbinic supervision. So the result, just to fast forward, is Akiva just got his first job at Motorola. He's now supporting his family. We believe that at a certain point, the tipping point will kick in, and this will become the new norm. And the beauty of these interventions in the Haredi sector is that they have tremendous displeasure, tremendous discipline, which is what it takes to learn Torah and Talmud all day at a yeshiva. And it's working. And what we need to help the Haredi community understand is that one can learn Torah and one can work, just as happens elsewhere in the world. I want to move over now to Europe. Europe's financial crisis has been raging since the global economic crash of 2008. Jews, too, were the victims, of course. In the Baltics, in Greece, in Bulgaria, all of these countries have been extremely hard hit by the economic woes. So we have enacted a community-centered relief program that simultaneously addresses social service care, employment opportunities, and Jewish community connection. And this strategic formula ensures rent and utility subsidies, medicine and healthcare, job training and skill development paired with Jewish school scholarships. The key focal point of ours is to make sure that communities weather the storm. I was in Athens, Greece, several months ago when I was in Israel. I went in for the day, and I met a community, a small Jewish community of about 3,500 to 4,000, who until 2012, totally self-sufficient for decades. They're wealthy and middle class and some poor. All of the poor are taken care of, or were taken care of before that, by those middle class and wealthy Jews, by the community, within the community. However, we're looking there today at close to 60% young adult unemployment. The Greek economy contracted over 25% in the last 6 years. Again, unfathomable to us who live in America, in Canada, and any of you who might be calling in from Israel. Unfathomable. We have no clue what that means. We're thinking depression of 1930s here in America, even heightened. And I will tell you, the shame of the new poor was overwhelming to me, deeply moving. So what we've done is make emergency grants that enable people not to drop out of the community, We've actually increased day school enrollment this year in Athens in order to do that. This is the same kind of work we're doing today in Bulgaria. It's the same kind of work we're doing today in Hungary. There have been questions with me about anti-Semitism in these countries, which we can field later. But at the same time, what I want to say to you is that this represents World Jewry, through the work that we're doing on World Jewry's behalf, is representing a lifeline to these communities, a Jewish lifeline, so that they can remain strong Jewish communities during tremendous economic distress. And these are just two stories of JDC's ever-evolving response to the many faces of global Jewish poverty. The key, as Dr. King said, is not to overlook the very circumstances that make our work, that make our Avodah Kodesh, so necessary. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Alan. Thank you for those inspiring words and a quick rundown on the subject matter and on where we stand and where we're headed. And thank you for your work and for the work of the Joint over these last 100 years. Probably more than 100 years with you and the Joint combined. We will take
privilege and pleasure.
We'll take Q&A again after we go through the three presenters. But feel free to type in any questions along the way that come to mind. It's now my honor to introduce Hannah Rosenthal. She is the CEO and president of the Milwaukee Jewish Federation. She's a nationally recognized leader who has served under two presidents. Most recently, she was President Obama's special envoy to monitor and combat anti-Semitism at the State Department.
Overall,
someone needs to press mute. Sorry about that. JDC, if you guys could press mute on the phone, maybe, or on the computer, that would be great, Alan. That being said, Hannah was the special envoy to monitor and combat anti-Semitism at the State Department. Before that, she was the executive director of the Chicago Foundation for Women, and was a senior official at the Department of Health and Human Services in the Clinton administration. She became very well known to many of us during her tenure as executive director of the Jewish Council for Public Affairs. Again, it is my honor, Hannah, to pass the baton to you to talk about this very important subject of pursuing justice. All yours.
Thanks so much, William, and thanks for the great work you're doing in Washington. And, Alan, greetings from Milwaukee. We claim you. It's going to be double digits, that warm today here. I am going to very quickly go through some of my thoughts, having left the national and international scene and come to a local community and seeing firsthand how economic inequities are playing out. I want to state at the outset, I'm pretty much stating the obvious. We all know that in the richest country in the world, to be seeing the kind of poverty and kind of need that we're seeing here is unconscionable, and that to be a Jew means to do something about it. So at the Federation level, let me tell you a few things that we're doing here in Milwaukee. Jewish poverty is often invisible in many, many ways. It's kind of hidden among the poverty population. But here in Milwaukee, on a good day, child poverty, Alan, you were talking about child poverty in Israel. Well, in Milwaukee and in many large and intermediate cities, child poverty is at the bottom 25%, and in certain elements of the community, over a third of the children are living in poverty. So this is an extremely serious and urgent issue globally and here in our local communities. Now, what we're seeing here is that people who are stepping forward, Jewish leaders in some cases, who live in zip codes where homes are large and one would never expect poverty to be part of their lives, are stepping forward. And they're asking for the $20 that they need for a copay for to take their kid to a pediatrician. Those kind of requests were happening from zip codes across our community and really set off alarms. We created a second line campaign to our annual campaign 2 years ago called J-Help, where the money that we would be raising would go specifically for grassroots support to those Jews in our community who are quite hidden, and in many cases are too proud or don't even know how to access services in the community at large. When we raised the money, we thought we had raised enough for 3 years of serving that population. A year and a half into it, we hardly have any money left. The urgency is being felt in our food pantries. It is being felt in housing issues. Our Jewish Family Services has opened two new housing facilities, one for disabled and one for the elderly, but we've got waiting lists. We have properties that we own where the poor are living, and it is terrible we don't have better and more housing for them. Now, William, you mentioned my tenure at the Jewish Council for Public Affairs. One of the things that we instigated during that period of time was an initiative called Confronting Poverty, and it was urging local communities to not only set up programs, but to be advocates for policies that have to do with people who are poor. And so while we all may run programs and while we may provide services, it isn't enough. Because just as the Federation system may be the central address and the community chest for Jewish giving, our government represents that for the country at large. And so we encourage communities and the good work you do, William, at the national level to view the policies that are happening in our state houses and in Congress as great moral challenges. When we look at a state or even a local or federal budget, we see them as great moral documents. What do they say about our community? What do they say about our society? And so when we look at some of the policies, in addition to the programs that are needed, but the policies that would cut eligibility for the poor to access Medicaid, or cuts in Medicare, or cuts in food stamps that people need to put food on their table, or cuts in the earned income tax credit for people who are earning money, but they need to have tax credits to make ends meet. When we see these kind of profound cuts happening at the federal, state, or local level, it is incumbent on us at the grassroots level in our communities to speak out, and speak out as a great moral challenge and consistent with our Jewish values that these are unacceptable. We have to recognize that every single decision that is made by policymakers is a decision that can be broken down into fundamental fairness. And we need a voice to point that out sometimes in the give and take and partisan gridlock that's happening. Now, there are some opportunities to mix advocacy and programs that we are seeing, that we're implementing here in our community in Milwaukee. I want to say that all the hubbub about the Pew study that was released in October and continues to be discussed and a lot of schreigavaulting about provides a great opportunity. We got a blueprint, or we got a snapshot from some organization, a very reputable organization, that did a thorough research of the Jewish community, not done by Jews. And they told us that the imperative to repair the world, to tikkun olam, to make sure that we are participating in fixing things, in mending the very fractured world we live in, needs to be a priority. That's what our young people want to be involved in, and that's where they see is the place to act on their Jewish values, particularly when it comes to the vulnerable populations that are experiencing such abject poverty. So we have a few things that are going on that I just wanted to throw out that are really important. One is we have instituted an initiative that actually we started at the State Department, but at the State Department, the only country we can't affect is the United States. So now that I'm not there anymore, we've initiated an initiative called Hours Against Hate, where we ask people to spend an hour or more of their time to help people they don't know, people that look different, they pray differently, they might live differently, they might love differently, that there's an outreach and a recognition that it is our Jewish imperative to reach out to them and see how we can be helpful 1 hour at a time. In our young leadership work, we're talking about adopting a disenfranchised community here in Milwaukee and actually pairing our young people with young people in these very destitute communities to build relationships, to better understand each other, and, of course, to make a difference. We are everything that happens with our JCRC, our Jewish Community Relations Council, everything they do is affecting this. They build coalitions. They provide public statements. They demand public statements from policy leaders and thought leaders in our community. And they know how to build partnerships, so we're not in it alone trying to mend the world. And when we have some special mending, we can turn to them because we've been there for them. Because it's also Women's History Month, I do want to point out that when we're talking about poverty and we're talking about how to fix things, we can't ignore the fact that a majority of families, the fastest growing segment of the population that's entering poverty or moving down to abject poverty, are single moms and their families. And to fully respond to that challenge calls for a completely different set or an additional set of policy issues and programs, including job training, including access to health care, including funding and policies and programs where they can go if they're victims of abuse, including programs that will specifically deal with women's empowerment because men and women are often poor for different reasons. I will cut off what I'm saying now by saying also, I started by saying I'm stating the opposite. I'm going to conclude by stating the opposite, the obvious. We are moved to do this because our Jewish values teach us that. It is the right thing to do to advocate for people who are less fortunate, to provide services to those people who have no one else providing services. But it is also in our enlightened self-interest that we do this. Because to the extent that we're living in neighborhoods and communities where our neighbors are desperate, it isn't good for us, it isn't good for our community, it isn't good for the community at large, and we have to recognize as vital parts of that community that it's the right thing to do and it's in our interest that we make sure that the poverty population is decreasing. I'm open to questions when we're done.
Great. Thank you very much, Hannah. Very inspiring and educational and thoughtful as always. It's
Thank you very much.
Nice to be back on the same screen with you. It is my pleasure now to introduce Rabbi Michael Paley. Rabbi Paley is the director of the Jewish Resource Center of UJA Federation of New York. He is an adjunct professor at the Columbia School of Journalism at City College and at the Ivry Prosdor High School of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. At UJA Federation of New York, he often lectures on a wide variety of subjects, including the weekly Torah portion, prayer and Jewish history, Jewish ethics and Islam, and I think it'll be a real delight to hear Rabbi Paley wrap it all up as the third of three speakers, and then we will open up for some Q&A. So, Rabbi, the floor is yours. Can other people hear him?
No.
Rabbi, we cannot hear you. Maybe can you unpress the mute button on your phone, perhaps? That sounded like a good noise. Still cannot hear you. I see you. Cannot hear you. Cannot hear you still. Emily, do you have guidance here? I know a little American Sign Language, Rabbi. If you want to sign it, I could.
Yeah, Rabbi Paley, do you mind calling? Hello, Rabbi Paley. Do you mind calling back in using the leader access pin? My guess is you didn't type in the four-digit number.
Great. So he is going to call in using the 4-digit leader code. Hopefully he has that. In the meantime, I will remind people that we can have a great conversation down here at the bottom of the screen, where we can talk about what's being said and also pose questions and have some framework and maybe tell some jokes. I want to remind people about program-wise that March 26th, Dr. Erica Brown from the Washington Federation will be doing another one of these conference calls towards the end of Professional Development Month. We also have the annual program of J-Pro Network, which will be May 28th at Rabbi Paley's office, actually, at UJA Federation of New York. So mark that on your calendars. The annual programs tend to be the most well-attended programs that we have and have a real star-studded cast. Rabbi, can you speak? We see your mouth moving, but we do not hear you still.
Rabbi Paley, I just sent Gina an email with the information with the access code. Make sure you're typing in the leader PIN, which is a 4-digit PIN.
We cannot hear you.
We still can't hear you.
Speaking, but we cannot hear you. Did you type in the 4-digit leader code? Nod your head yes, if so. We see your mouth moving, but do not... there we go. Hi, Hannah. While Emily, maybe you can call the rabbi's office.
Yeah, I'll do that now.
I see there's a question. I see there's a question for me.
Hannah,
can you hear me?
Thank you for the lifeline.
I see there's a question. Given that Tikkun Olam is a universal value across many faiths, how does this impact our potential to engage the Jewish community around this value? Well, we have to make it a value. We have to make it a priority. And while we're teaching a variety of Torah lessons, etc., we have to bring it back to the language of calling for action. And, you know, it is so fundamental to us, sometimes we forget to highlight its importance in Jewish activism as an important part of what it means to be a Jew. So I think it provides great potential. And what we heard from the Pew Report was that those individuals born in 1980 and beyond, like my children, for instance, that they're very focused on acting on their Jewish values, very solid in their Jewish identity. But what they want to do is do something, not just sit in class, not just sit in a synagogue, not that they don't want to do that, but they see a need for more activism. And that's what I was trying to get at, as ways to engage these young people and older in ways of moving to not just learning about Jewish values, but acting on them.
Excellent. Alan Gill, are you still
here?
Yes, now we can hear you.
Oh, good.
Can you hear me? Oh.
I can hear you too, Alan, but we're going to move to Michael. And we'll, Michael, you can do your shtick, and then we'll do Q&A. And so Alan and Hannah and I will press stop broadcasting so everybody can see you front and center.
All right, so you can hear me now? Good.
Yes, loud and clear.
So, I really wanted to start where Hannah started, which was she said, to be a Jew is to do something about it. And that's the real message. You know, it's wonderful to think about Dr. Martin Luther King any time of the year. I'm happy that the weather cooperated in New York to make us think that it's actually in the middle of January. So we're all cheering here. The idea that Martin Luther King harkens up for me, of course, is the Selma March of 1965. And that march with the kind of iconic picture of Abraham Joshua Heschel in the front row. And his wonderful sentence, which was that I felt my legs were praying. And in some ways, that is the theology of Heschel, which is that you should, that in order for you to really become a God-fearing person, in order for you to become a fully realized Jew, particularly after the Holocaust, particularly after the great destructions of the early part of the 20th century, then what you can I can't. Then what you have to do is you have to actually be an activist. You have to actually confront the world around you. You have to actually do things. And his relationship with Martin Luther King was in some ways the one that is the most interesting to think about. The one thing that King always said that he learned from Heschel was optimism. That no matter what was going on, no matter what was going on, even in the darkest days of Montgomery and of Selma and those places, that Heschel would come down and he would mobilize the Jewish community around him, not all the Jewish community. There were certainly opponents in the Jewish community. There were people that were opposed to the turbulence of the movement, and there were also people that saw all the entire black nationalist movement as anti-Semitic and violent, even though there's no doubt that Martin Luther King preached strongly against it. But the phrase of moral grandeur and spiritual audacity, this that we have to do something great, that we have to do something that's abiding, and that it has to be audacious, we can actually change the world, that was something different in King, and it was also different in Heschel. It was really holding God and humanity together, that it was an intertwined politics and theology. And that it was also, in some ways, a move back to the prophets, that the prophets of the Torah also said, you can't go in the streets, you can't look at problems, you can't look at the poor and think that you can do nothing. You have to actually push it. You have to actually engage in it. You actually have to confront it. So when you listen to Alan and Hannah about what they're doing, about what the Jewish community is mobilized to do, that is the, I think, the real answer to the challenge of Martin Luther King. It's also important and interesting to note that Martin Luther King decided to use Exodus as the images that he preached about. I'm on the mountaintop. I see the promised land. I'm also parting the waters. All of those things, he did that instead of using Jesus because he said, I want the Jewish community and the Christian community to come together. He actually was part of the National Conference of Christians and Jews. And that use of Exodus was the sense that no matter what we think of our situation, you know, whether you're a Jew now in Kiev or you were a slave in Egypt or you were a black person living in the South or even in the North, jobless and destitute and poor, that there was still a way that the waters could part and that you could move forward. I wanted to just think about it for a minute because I've used a lot of my time.
Can you?
Rabbi, we just lost you. Rabbi? Michael? Okay, let me, I will continue to stretch for a minute here. We lost you again, Rabbi, but I know we got the crux of it, which is also very inspirational about, certainly following the tradition of Abraham Joshua Heschel, big shoes that we all as Jews have a responsibility to try to fill. Let me go to some questions if that works for everybody, and maybe Alan, you can turn your camera back on. There is a question here from Linda Spirit from Baltimore, who asks, in what specific ways can we engage members of the Jewish community who grew up in the 1960s and are ardent advocates of social justice in the general community to become committed to and make financial investments in the same cause within the Jewish community? That is an excellent question. And Alan, why don't you go first?
I'll be happy to. It's a question as a baby boomer myself who grew up in the 60s, very close to my heart. I'll tell you my story. I would probably not be sitting here today doing what I do, caring about what I care for, if not for an epiphany that I had in the mid-70s when I was in graduate school and at Ohio State University, and a Jewish fellow tapped me on the shoulder and said to me, there's a demonstration today, tonight, at the Ohio Theater downtown. The Bolshoi Ballet is coming. Are you going? And I said, what's your problem? You know, you can't get a ticket? And he looked at me and he said, Soviet Jewry. And I said, what are you talking about? Okay, Ashanti, I didn't know. It was still under the radar screen of the mainstream of Jewish community life. It was a student struggle of Soviet Jewry. I went, and I had this epiphany. Kol Yisrael Arvim Zelazed, those people are my people. It's what, and maybe Rabbi Paley can talk about it, proximity does. I believe firmly that Kol Yisrael Arvim Zelazed is the greatest gift that Judaism can give to humankind. To show the world as a light unto others, that if we care for ourselves, tikkun olam is what will come from that. It doesn't absent us from our responsibility to the greater world, but that proximity, that sense of peoplehood, and actualizing it through real work, demonstrations, politically, giving aid to people across the world, our people when they're in need, it speaks very strongly. It speaks strongly to the baby boomers when we learn how to talk to them. It speaks strongly to their children, I will tell you. We have this entwined program. It's absurd to think that what got us here won't get us there. That after millennia, this sense, this what's in our so-called, I use it not advisedly, DNA as a people, is not transmittable to others in our generation and to the next generation. That's what I believe speaks very strongly to them.
I think that, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead. Welcome aboard, Michael.
I think that what the 60s was really about was a recommitment to optimism in the future. The future could be better than the past. And it wasn't always going to be the same. And in some of the ways that our parents had told us, our grandparents had told us, this was going to happen, that was going to happen, it could be different. And in some ways, you know, now that I'm a baby boomer with gray hair and a gray beard, I'm sobered by some of my fantasies, but I'm not sobered by my dreams. The dreams of King and the dreams of Herzl, you know, of all the dreams that we had, these are still dreams. They still motivate us. And the value-added part of Judaism is the narrative. We have this story that we got out and that we cared about each other and that we could actually create, in times of despair, a better world. This was the great moment. You know, you have to feel that in Jewish life, there's some kind of value added. And there's a great sentence in the Talmud. Commitment to God is inconceivable in Judaism without compassion for man. And that is, for me, an important comment. That was the nexus that King and Heschel and people like that made. And that, I think, is a motivator for baby boomers and for the next generation as well.
Can I weigh in? Can you hear me?
Yep, go ahead, Hannah.
Listening to what you said, I too am a baby boomer, and I'll just tell a very short bit of my story. My father was a Holocaust survivor, and only, you know, later in life did I realize what that must have been for him. He just was my dad, you know, that's all I knew. But he was also a rabbi. And talk about he also marched in Selma with Martin Luther King. He was a role model. He was a very learned rabbi, ordained in Germany. He was an Orthodox rabbi. He was brilliant, but he was an activist. And maybe it was because he came out, and the only survivor of his family to come out of the Holocaust. But one thing he used to say to me is, don't become paralyzed. And we in the 60s, as the question was asked, there were all these movements happening. There was the women's movement. There was the anti-war movement. There was the Soviet Jewry movement that followed. These were specific movements with specific tasks that allowed people to engage. Right now, some would say we're not in war. Some would say there's been tremendous success from the civil rights movement. Some would say there's been significant success from the women's movement, and so forth and so forth. But, you know, the crises, the problems are still there. And we're dealing with a completely different context where people might not come to a rally. They'll do Twitter. They're using different forms of communication and different forms of calling people to activism. But connected Jews, and the ones we're trying to get connected, to Jewish institutions and Jewish actions, call for leadership. And it calls for our leaders, whether they're lay leaders, whether they're rabbis, whether they're, you know, committee chairmen, whatever it is, that they have a responsibility to translate all the wonderful things that you just said, Michael, into concrete action. And that becomes, you know, I think there's some complacency in our people because we're not having it so bad right now. I talked about 25% poverty rate here. You talked about a third child poverty rate in Israel. There, we have needy people in our community, but we're pretty comfortable. And so we have to know how to translate the realities and the Jewish values and what Torah and Talmud tell us into concrete actions. And that was, if I may just promote, the example that I used, which is the Hours Against Hate campaign. Because it answered what my father always said, don't become paralyzed by the enormity of a problem. Break it into doable parts. And so we've all been involved in trying to stop hunger in our community. We bring our cans to synagogue on the holidays. We all know that when there is a march commemorating King's speeches and the African-American community asks our participation, we show up. But we have to figure out in what the Hours Against Hate campaign provides us. You don't have to use it. But the model was break it into doable parts. Ask people for 1 hour. Not a commitment of a lifetime, not asking them for a lot of money. Hopefully with engagement they will invest in the Jewish community because they'll see us as relevant and see us as responding to what they're telling us, which is give me something to do. So I just wanted to say the enormity of the problem can paralyze us. And the message I got from my optimistic activist father, Orthodox rabbi, who became, who turned it into action, that having a profound leader really moves the community. And we have to ask that of our leaders.
Excellent points. Let me, Norman Olshansky, the former Federation CEO in Sarasota, has an observation and a question that I think ties into this exactly what we're talking about. His observation is that as a boomer, I'd suggest that speaking in generalities about values is important, but we need more stories of real people that help us connect to the needs through the eyes of those experiencing the day-to-day results of inequity, so it will help move people beyond empathy to action. And the question, how can we create more opportunities for our Jewish community to go touch, feel, and be involved beyond seeing a video or attending a lecture? And I think it speaks to this whole, you know, I bring a can during high holidays to a shul, and I've done my part for the homeless. Check that box off, and I'm done. Certainly better than I bring a can than I don't, but hopefully there's more action than that. And seeing a video, attending a lecture, there's this whole concept, we talked about social media, of what's called liketivism, which is activism through liking on Facebook, right? I'm helping the people of Ukraine by liking the JDC's post, which is certainly better than not liking it. So I wonder, we can go around the horn, some thoughts on this, on how to move people beyond the simple and the relatively inane.
Go
ahead, Michael.
I don't take for granted that people want to do good in the world, and I don't take for granted that people want to gather and change. And even the collectivism that you talk about, I don't take for granted that people in the world have such incredible access to each other to be mobilized right now. I do think that the stories that we tell, you know, you say, you know, bring cans to shul on Yom Kippur. I'm happy that people go to shul on Yom Kippur. I'm happy that people still think that that is the thing to do on those days of year to be inspired to really act and change the world. I think that lots of people have good values and they want to do good and nobody wants to be poor and things. But, you know, there have been many cultures in the history of the world that didn't care about the poor and they didn't care about people that were under duress. And they wouldn't reach out their arms from New York City and Cleveland and Milwaukee and Washington to Kiev and to Hungary and to North Africa. And there aren't all people. principles of the world, particularly a community that cares so much about people, peoplehood, as we do right now, that still wants to open up its arms and embrace the whole world. I think those stories that we tell are important. I had my own stories. You know, my parents grew up in suburban Boston, and they had it pretty good. You know, in fact, I wouldn't say that. I would say they had it great. You know, they were Americans, and they were prosperous, and they were doing great in the 1960s. And yet, I remember every night my mother and my father would almost alternate between going to causes of the NAACP and causes of Games of Merit came to our house, and Thurgood Marshall, you know, I went to a dinner with him when I was a kid. All these people inspired me so much so that by the time I was in high school, I thought to be Jewish was to support blacks. That was the idea. And it only later occurred to me that my father was going from place to place to raise money for the CJP of Boston, the Combined Jewish Philanthropies, so that he could also engage himself in Jewish causes. And in some ways, those stories of our 1960s behavior are the stories we have to tell our kids, because both are important. And I don't take for granted that the move towards a better future is just a natural impulse. We can see plenty of societies, Kiev, in fact, in which the opposite is a natural impulse. The shutting down of society is a natural impulse.
Okay.
I'll be happy. We could go around the horn. By the way, Hannah, Milwaukee claims me, given that I sat in the building you're in for several years and left a piece of my heart back. So please do say hi to all my friends. I do believe that there's no single approach. I want to ask ourselves a question. Few to none of us on this call, I'm sure, have been through an earthquake, have been through a hurricane, have been through devastating human disasters like the tsunami. And yet, Jews, as well as non-Jews, responded en masse. Of course, it had the backdrop of constant coverage. Of course, it had the drama that only a crisis and emergency can give. And yet, they came. They came forward because of the media, because of communications. People are active in and give to things that they never see, touch, and feel. I'm not saying that, you know, of course, we all agree that you got to get, that the ideal is to bring people to really be close and personal with the issues we're trying to address, the problems we're trying to solve as Jews, as human beings. At the same time, I think that we have to do a much better job in how we communicate. I would not discount the narrative. The narrative is key. The narrative and the messages are key. And I, you know, being self-critical is we must be as professionals. And I say that about, you know, myself and about our own organization. We have to up the game. We have to do a much better job of getting our stories out, getting them to people. I could tell you that every time there's a Jewish urgency or emergency anywhere in the world, people come out of the woodwork. It's a question of how to reach them.
Thank you. Hannah, you might have the last word here. Maybe take it home, and then I will do some closing thanks.
Well, I want to thank you for including me in this program with this esteemed panel. Let me just close by saying I'm part of a federation system, as are you, William, and Michael, and frankly, your funding, Alan. Often we talk about our success as how big our campaign is, instead of telling the stories and putting pictures and faces to the reality that, of what we're doing. JDC does a better job of that than anyone. And while I am proud to be part of the Federation system, I really want to salute what JDC does. The pictures that we put up, that somebody technologically knew what to put up when I was talking, those came from JDC, the international ones. You're on the ground when there's an earthquake, when there's a crisis, when there's a revolution. JDC is there, and I'm proud that when I'm fundraising here at the Federation, that I get to tell your story. We have to figure out our local stories better. We need to talk about our neighbors and what we're doing with our neighbors in addition to what we're doing across the pond. And so I want to thank everybody for what they're doing. Thank you for including me. And for the participants, don't forget it's Women's History Month, too.
Okay. It's also Purim, you know. Purim is what's on earth, and that's the story about a young girl, you know, probably who knows how old she was, that said, if I perish, I perish. I'm going to try and change the world and save the Jews.
Correct.
I'm going to try and make this world a better place. I agree with Alan. The narrative is everything, and we've been pretty good at telling stories. We should practice with Purim, and we should practice with Passover, and then we should tell the story of our own lives.
Amen. Well, thank you all. Thank you for that. I thank, Alan Gill. I thank, Hannah Rosenthal. I thank, Rabbi Michael Paley. And I thank all of you for participating as well over the phone and over the web. I want to remind everyone that again on March 26th, our colleague, Dr. Erica Brown, will have a program that you can sign up for, a conference call. And then our annual conference for JPRO Network will be May 28th, in New York. All of this information is available on the web, which is jcsana.org. So on behalf of JPRO Network and on behalf of my colleagues, thank you all for participating, and we'll see you all when we see you in an early Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.